The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control and published in JAMA, the Journal for the American Medical Association, says the suicide rate in the United States has spiked by 33% to the highest level since World War II over the last 20 or so years. And among young people between the ages of 15 and 24, the suicide rate is the highest it's been since the government started keeping track in 1960, so that could mean ever. So what's going on here? Why are we killing ourselves in such huge numbers? I really want to dig into this topic. We're going to talk about it, and we will see if we can get to the source. Now, joining us in the studio now is Brooke Fina. She's an associate professor with the Department of Psychiatry at UT Health San Antonio and leads the Strong Star Training Initiative. What's Strong Star? It's the South Texas Research Organizational Network guiding studies on trauma and resilience. Trauma and resilience. I have a feeling those two words are going to come up a time or two over the next hour. We're also joined by Michelle Mata. She's a mental wellness advocate, a peer mentor, a state trainer, and presenter for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And she's also been there and is suffering from depression and suicidal ideation. And I'm sure that informs your thoughts and understanding of the subject. I'm sure we'll touch on that. And we're also joined by Waikisha McKinney, who is with us over the phone from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP, and me. In 1989, when I was 19 years old, my 15-year-old sister killed herself. So I come to this topic as a sort of suicide loss survivor who keenly understands what the loss of one member of the family can do to the rest of the family. So let's get into this conversation now. If you'd like to talk about your experiences, by the way, with suicide, why it's happening, do you think, so much more often, and what we can do to ease the pain suffered by so many of our neighbors, family members, and friends, maybe even you, please call us. You can do so anonymously. Our number is 210-614-8980, or you can email us at thesource@tpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. So these numbers are from that CDC report and the study in JAMA, and they're really, to me, kind of a punch in the gut. I'm sure both of you agree. And standing out to me is this stunning increase in suicide among young men in particular. Also racial minorities like Indigenous women, their suicide rate more than doubled and is, in fact, the largest increase in the research. So I want to start with you, Brooke. Brooke Fina with Strong Star, trying to figure out how to help veterans in particular. I'm sure you know these numbers better than anyone. But were you surprised by this report?
Yes and no. Obviously, it's staggering and upsetting, and there's a call to action, I think, for the field of suicide researchers as well as civilians alike. You know, I think when we think about these numbers and the changes over the years, unfortunately, we don't exactly know why yet. There's a lot of research going on to understand what might be the reasons that we're seeing increases. There's some thoughts about the opioid crisis, of course, in the country. But also, I think as a field, we're getting actually better at identifying what is suicide and what isn't.
Right.
Understanding that, and that's making its way into reports. And that's, even though the numbers are devastating, that's a good thing because that will allow us then to consider, you know, the reasons why for these specific populations.
All right. Michelle, your thoughts when you hear these numbers?
As a peer, someone living with a mental health diagnosis and suicidal ideations, it's saddening because these are people just like myself, mm-hmm. living life, trying to get through the day, working, school, raising families. is just saddening.
Yeah, yeah. Are you surprised to see an increase of 33% overall, the entire population?
Yes, I'm surprised. But I can only speak for myself. I know that living my life and what's happened to me, I'm actually a survivor of childhood abuse. Mm-hmm. And so some of my diagnoses and the fact that I have all these suicidal ideations stem from that. And I don't know what everybody is dealing with. It's different from the next person.
Do you think that's part of the why, Brooke?
Absolutely, and thanks so much for sharing that. It's always so helpful to hear people's personal experiences. One of the things we are learning more and more from the research is that the experience of trauma, and also for some, the experience of post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD seems to be a really, really important factor as it relates to people experiencing suicidal thoughts, behaviors, attempts, right, and those who die by suicide. So this is something that's consistent when we look at the research related to people in the military, right? Service members, veterans, as well as people who've never served in the military. So that's one of the key factors that we're starting to hone in on.
Okay. I'd like to go to the phone where we have Waikisha McKinney with the American Federation for Suicide Prevention. Waikisha, I've done several AFSP walks. I know a large part of your organization's role is, you know, supporting families. And now, yeah, with these numbers, there's so many more families to support. How does that impact the work you do?
So we're definitely paying very close attention to, what's needed. And what we know is that for every one person that dies by suicide, up to 100 folks could be impacted by that one loss, and 6 to 8 people very intimately affected by that one loss. So while we're seeing that increase, we are identifying ways that we can continue to support those families who have been impacted by a suicide loss. We have several different resources and campaigns available that are very helpful for families who have lost a loved one to suicide, particularly our Healing Conversations program, where we have volunteers who are survivors of suicide loss connect with new survivors and kind of help guide them through what the next month, what the next year will look like and what resources are available to support them.
And that's really important, right? Because isn't a risk factor for suicide having someone in your family having completed a suicide?
Absolutely. That is a risk factor for suicide. So survivors of suicide loss, like myself, are at a little bit of an increased risk because we have had that close personal experience with a suicide death. And then also the complicated grief that comes with having lost someone to suicide and taking on kind of the guilt and the responsibility of that person's suicide adds to the complexity of our grief, which also increases our risk.
I have a friend whose teenage son committed suicide last year, and she's spent a lot of time, rightly so, trying to help her teenage daughter through it, because I think, and you can tell me what you think, are teenagers more vulnerable to this type of thing?
Teens are a very high-risk population. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for teens. Ages kind of 15 and 24, and this recent research that you mentioned earlier is showing that we're seeing an increase in numbers with kids at a younger age and also children of color.
So all right, Waikisha, I'm going to interrupt you. We are going to go to the break. Then we'll talk more about this afterward. Join our conversation. We do have some callers. Give us a call, 210-614-8980, or you can email us at thesource@tpr.org. The Source continues right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies. We're talking about the 33% increase in suicides reported by the CDC and the Journal of the American Medical Association in the United States over the last 20 years. And I want to go right to the phones right now so we can start talking about the whys before we start talking about the what we can do part of the whole thing. And I know that, Brooke, you said that we don't really know why, but we know some whys. Yes. And Antonio is with us on the phone, and he has a theory that it might have. And I know this is a common theory, something to do with social media. Antonio, what are your thoughts?
Basically, I think it's social media. I am a 36-year-old guy, and I was there for the beginning of MySpace, and I understood what was going on. It was to gather information on people, but I think what it ultimately did was people started building this persona of themselves, and a lot of these personas that aren't real. For an example, a high school jock that goes up to a college off two states away. He becomes a rocker or a skateboarder, you know, and when he comes back home 4 years later, and he doesn't, you know, he's not surrounded by that, and it's...
Yeah. Antonio, your phone line is a little bit wonky there, but I think we got your point. Michelle Mata with NAMI. Tell me, what do you think about that? What do you think the role of these personas that we build on social media for old folks like me, it's the Facebooks, but for 14-year-olds like my daughter, it's the Instagram show, as I call it, so that she'll think I'm particularly lame. So what do you think, this idea of trying to keep up this image that you've created?
Well, I'm 48 years old, and so I've only learned about Facebook in the past few years, and I think I hear... a lot about, you know, having a lot of friends on Facebook.
Sure.
The more friends you have, the more popular you are. I used to think that too when I first started. And it was like, I want more friends. I want more friends. I want more friends on my Facebook account. The only thing is that they're not there for me in real life.
Sure.
And when I need somebody to talk to, they're not there. And having somebody on Facebook or social media, I think we build up that persona so that we can look good to somebody else. But inside, we're not. We don't feel the way other people see us on Facebook.
I think there are a couple of things going on. Well, more than a couple of things going on when we start to talk about the internet and social media, particularly with young people, but for all of us. I'll direct this at you, Brooke, with StrongStar. We need social support. We need support systems, right? They're essential to human beings, social creatures. We need them. And we think we have them on the internet. To some degree, we do. But can you tell me if there's anything in the research about relationships and support systems and the advent of the internet related to suicide?
Yeah. So we also know from... you know, a research perspective that relationships and social support is incredibly important and a important protective factor when we think about those who experience suicidal thoughts and behaviors. And there are things we do know as to what makes people more vulnerable. And I think if we think about social media and some of the things that the caller said, is that, you know, one of the things we do know that increases people's vulnerability is the way they think about themselves and other people. And when I say that, I mean the not so helpful thoughts or the unrealistic thoughts about the way they see themselves and other people. Thoughts about maybe, you know, feeling worthless or a burden to others or, you know, not as good as other people.
Right.
And so I think one of the challenges of social media is that sometimes when people can interface with that medium, that can tick up those thoughts.
Sure.
And kind of influence as they do a suicidal crisis.
Okay, mm-hmm. So you're listening to The Source, and we want you to be a part of the conversation. If you'd like to be, you can do it anonymously at 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. Waikisha with AFSP. Yep. Let's stay on social media for a minute, and I'm going to lob a lot of the young people questions at you. So there's this idea of chasing likes and bullying and all of that stuff that is so hard on teenagers in particular.
Right.
Is that something that you've run into? And you know, parents like me, middle schoolers going into high school, or we want to know, you can't take them off the social media, right? It's life. Or can you? Let's have your thoughts, Waukesha.
Well, again, I'm also a parent of a middle schooler going to eighth grade. And, you know, I think that definitely there is a culture amongst our teenagers to get validation from likes, you know, or whatever that connection is that they're looking for. They're looking for that through Facebook and social media. The challenge with that is that they may not necessarily get the affirmation or the attention that they're looking for. On social media. In fact, they may get the wrong attention. And bullying is heightened and escalated by leaps and bounds when you add in Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat and all of these other mediums, you know, all these other platforms that the kids can go on. Now the bullying is not just at school. The kids can't get away from it. They leave school, and now they have tweets and text messages and snaps and Instagram posts, and it continues to kind of add and escalate to that feeling of hopelessness and the feelings of worthlessness that come along with being bullied.
So I think that Michelle Mata with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, I think we know all that stuff, right? We've been talking about all that stuff for years, how, you know, the pressure to match up and the bullying and the intensity, not being able to escape. When we were kids, we're the same age, we could go home and put our Phil Collins record on a record player and we're done. You know, we don't have to think about it for right. 12 hours. This is intense and it follows you. Does NAMI have any sort of tools for parents or children, teenagers, to deal with all this stuff?
Well, NAMI San Antonio actually has a couple of educational programs free of charge to the public. One of them is the NAMI Basics class, which is actually, it's not for children. It's actually for parents and loved ones who have someone under the age of 18 with a diagnosis. And it's to help parents or loved ones better understand what their child is going through, what the child is going through, better understand what the diagnosis, what the diagnosis is, and what does it take to get them better. They talk about medications. They talk about how to help the child, how to de-escalate. They find resources. They even, when the parents or the loved ones come together, there's actually now a built-in support system. And so parents and loved ones actually exchange phone numbers and actually support each other in this. NAMI San Antonio also has the Family to Family class, which is a 12-week course right now for family members or loved ones who have someone over the age of 18. And it's the same concept where the parents and loved ones come together, and it could be brothers, sisters, husband, wives, boyfriend, girlfriends, partners, a friend. They can come in together and learn about what their loved one's going through and how to de-escalate, how to better help their loved ones and learn about their diagnosis and what happens when we're in a crisis, and also about self-care, how to take care of themselves while they're taking care of somebody who is living with a diagnosis as well.
And I want to just jump in there because a lot of people, there's a lot of talk about self-care these days, mm-hmm. and it's become like get a pedicure and, yeah. you know, and get a facial. And self-care is making sure you have an uninterrupted, nutritious meal every day.
Right.
It's sleep hygiene and 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep. You know, it's taking time for yourself.
Correct.
In those sort of healthy ways.
It looks different for everybody.
Sure. So tell me a little bit more about what is self-care really? I mean, it might be a pedicure, right?
It could be if that's what I love to do. I don't love to do that.
But it's more basic than that, right?
Right. It's getting enough sleep. It's eating well. It's doing the things that you love to do. It's going out, and if you've been invited to a gathering, an event, a party. Some parents I hear that they don't want to go because what if, you know, my son, you know, has a crisis and I'm over here, mm-hmm. You know, having fun. Well, that's what you want to do. If the crisis is going to happen, you know, you can't avoid it.
Right.
It's going to happen at home. It's going to happen when you're out. It's going to happen if you're out of town. But just go on with life. Don't stop doing the things that you need to do in order to take care of your loved one. It's going to happen regardless.
Strengthening yourself, right, and your own emotional health. It strengthens the people around you, right?
Make time for your other loved ones in the family as well. Sometimes they put too much attention on the individual that's living with a diagnosis that they sometimes neglect the other family members. If you're married or if you have a significant other, you know, you need to make time with them as well.
Sure, sure. All this is very important. I'm going to shift gears slightly and move over to you, Brooke, because you're a psychiatrist, right?
And social worker.
A social worker. Same thing to me because you guys do amazing work. So people who have people in their lives who may be having suicidal ideation, which we'll go into detail about what that may be later on in the show. But you may not know what's going on, right? I remember looking at my sister a couple of months before she died and having a thought that she might be on the brink of something like that. But I had no evidence, no indication of that. So I start going, oh, you're crazy. You're being silly. You're being dramatic. So how do people know when to hit the panic button? It's so hard to say, is this normal teenage? Is this puberty? Is this what puberty likes? Wow, I heard it was bad, but this is really rough for a mom to their kid. Tell me, what do you look for? And then what do you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So first thing I would say is it is incredibly hard. And if we were better at identifying a crisis in our own lives and other people's lives, you know, maybe the numbers wouldn't be as high as they are. But it's an incredibly challenging position to be in, both the person who's experiencing a suicidal crisis as well as the loved ones around them. So when we think about kind of talking to people about what's going on, one of the things we've learned from research is that it's okay to ask. So historically, there's been some thoughts, oh, if I ask if someone is experiencing suicidal thoughts or emotional crisis, it's actually going to make it worse or it's going to put these thoughts in their head. And that is simply not the case. We know that from our experiences, and we also know that from the research that's been done. So I think if you're wondering or you're curious, asking if someone's okay, asking directly if they're having thoughts of suicide or if they've engaged in any behaviors related to those thoughts would be one step. But it's still hard.
It is really hard because I think that as a culture, and maybe it's just my family culture, but as a culture, we tend to go, oh, you're just overreacting. Mm-hmm. There's not really anything that seriously wrong going on. Why are you being so dramatic?
Absolutely. And that's why some of the work that NAMBI does and, you know, thinking about this from a public health perspective and trying to reduce stigma for anyone who's experiencing these kinds of crisis and the loved ones around them is really important.
So we're going to want to take more callers, and there are a couple of questions I'd like to toss out to our callers. Let me get our number. I don't have it memorized, so I have to look it up. It is 210-614-8980. You can be anonymous if you'd like. You could email anonymously at thesource@tpr.org. One question that I'd like to talk about, and I'm going to toss this out to the callers, is do you think suicide is a supremely selfish act? We hear that all the time when people die by suicide. So I'd like to hear what you think. And also, I'd like to know if you have sought help, perhaps, in San Antonio for mental health issues, suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts. Let me know how that went. Give us a call. We'd love to talk to you. 210-614-8980, again, and at thesource@tpr.org. You're listening to The Source. I'm Bonnie Petrie in Fort David, Martin Davies.
Immigration.
I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Health.
The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
Art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies, and we are talking about a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control that says over the last 20 years, the suicide rate in the United States has gone up 33% to the highest point since World War II. And particularly hard hit in this report were minority populations. And Waikisha McKinney of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, she's with us on the phone. You touched on that a bit, and I want you to elaborate a bit more. I have the numbers for women right in front of me. I don't have them for the whole population, but in every single ethnic group, in every single age category, I should say, Black, Asian, Pacific Islander, American Indian, Alaska Native, and Hispanic, in every case, higher than white women. So let's talk about that.
So I think that as far as the most recent data and things are concerned, I will say that I think a lot of the data and information that we're seeing right now is definitely due to an improvement in the way that we collect information about suicide and also in the way that we are studying and learning about suicide. So we're seeing kind of those increases, but also so we're seeing those increases kind of due to the improvement in research and the improvement in the ways that we're learning about suicide, right? Mm-hmm. On the other side of that, though, and some of the kind of social factors and things associated with suicide risk, I think that like with our minority groups, our Asian Pacific Islanders, African Americans, and things like that, there are some social factors or social constraints that also contribute to that increased risk.
So let's talk about those. What are they?
Okay. So, for instance, you know, there has been quite a bit of research as far as our American Indian and Alaska Native population and the risk factors associated with their increase in suicide. So it's definitely, you know, kind of the high poverty rates, the lack of access to mental health care resources, the lack of access to resources, or even the lack of access to counselors and therapists that look like them. And that's also a challenge and a risk factor for African Americans and Hispanic communities as well, where they're a little less likely to go to see a therapist or a counselor, especially if they can't find one that can relate to them culturally. So I think that is, a larger risk factor that we need to take a look at and figure out how we can work on that to help to, you know, reduce those risk factors and really improve access to mental health care resources for those groups.
It seems like that's true in every part of medical care, right? That people in minority populations don't get the kind of care that they need
right.
to have good outcomes. How do we improve that?
So I don't have a, you know, I don't, I wish I did have an answer for that. I'd probably
sure.
be a very wealthy person. but I don't have an altogether answer for that. I do know that, you know, there definitely needs to be our systems of care in general, whether that be physical care or mental health care, definitely have to be more focused on culture and how culture plays a role in our health and well-being. And work with our culture as opposed to working against it.
All right. Great. Thank you for that insight. And we'll probably delve into that more throughout the show. I'd like to go to the phone, though, right now. We know that some vulnerable populations are vulnerable, but still the message doesn't seem to get out as widely as we would like it to. And Jane is joining us on the phone, who is a survivor of postpartum depression. And that's a really tough experience. Jane, tell me what happened.
Hi. Okay, so I had my daughter, and then I just started getting these, like, anxiety episodes, and I would overthink things in my head. I would break down, have panic attacks, start crying. I had never experienced any of this before. And then I just got pretty depressed. I was scared to be alone with my thoughts every day, and so I was like scared to be in my own body, sort of, in a way. And I did end up seeing a counselor, but my comment for you guys was just on anxiety, not anxiety, but on suicide being selfish.
Yeah.
My thoughts are that it's more complex than that. Mm-hmm. From the outside, it is selfish. Like, if I was to take my life, there is no way that I would not be selfish, that that would not affect my husband and my child. Mm-hmm. But I think that they're seeing, the person going through this is seeing it, they have a whole different schema. It doesn't seem that way to them. It's something, suicide is something almost that they, there's no, there, sorry, I'm getting nervous.
That's okay. No, 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 that's okay.
There is a huge reason why people who commit suicide, they normally shoot themselves in the head. And that's because they're trying to make their brain stop. Mm-hmm. And if you can control your brain, then you're in charge. But if your brain's in control, you're kind of screwed. And I feel that that's the way it is with people who suffer from severe depression and severe anxiety. And although from the outside we can see it is very selfish, you have to realize that these people are going through something where they can't even see the outside world. It's a crisis from within.
All right, Jane, thank you. I'm going to go to Michelle on this. Michelle Mata with, I'm going to say it not like a Yankee this time, NAMI. I think in all the reading that I've done that people who are having suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation, and if you'd like to, you could define each, they really think the people around them will be better off if they're gone, if they think about that at all. What was your experience?
That is my experience. I have suicidal ideations where I think about suicide probably on a daily basis sometimes, if not weekly. But it is about me thinking that my family is better off if I'm not alive anymore, because my life is so chaotic and I feel like I'm a burden on them, and their life would improve if I wasn't in it.
So it sounds like the opposite of selfish when you put it that way. So how do you get it right in your head? I mean, obviously you're still here, thank goodness. You're with us. So how do you straighten that out so that you realize and understand that your kids need you, they love you, and they don't want you to go anywhere? And neither does anybody in this room, by the way.
Thank you. Get psychiatric help.
Mm-hmm.
Reach out to the medical professional, the mental health professionals. Get into, see a therapist, find a support group. Learn, you know, we have in NAMI, we have the NAMI peer-to-peer, which is an 8-week course for individuals with a diagnosis over the age of 18. I'm one of the peer mentors that facilitates the peer-to-peer class. And we all get together and we share our stories to one another and we support one another. Find something that it helps you find your rainbow.
But in that moment, when your brain goes there, how do you rein it in?
One of the things that I have to do is I try not to isolate.
Mm-hmm.
Once I start isolating, that's where my life starts getting dark.
Mm-hmm.
And if I start isolating and don't reach out to anybody, That's a downhill spiral right there. So I need to get up, take a shower, get dressed, and head out the door.
And Brooke, that sort of brings us back to this illusion of connectivity we have on the internet. But in many cases, people who live these lives online, they can't isolate. What's the risk of that isolation?
I think it's absolutely what Michelle is talking about from her experience. And, you know, it's one of the things that is really important in treatment that we consider is how to support people in expanding over time their social networks. I think Michelle also brought up another really important point. What we know about the treatments that are most effective is one of the things we do is really try to help people work on those thoughts that in the moment feel so powerful, that kind of get us into tunnel vision and that suicidal crisis, but aren't so helpful or even realistic. So that's a strong focus in the treatments we know that work for suicidal thoughts and behaviors.
Antonio, I'm going to go to the phone. He has thoughts about where people get referred when they start to talk to mental health professionals or health professionals, period, about their thoughts and feelings. Antonio, tell me what's on your mind.
Yes. I'm a psychotherapist in private practice, and the particular problems I have with people with bipolar or depression is when they have suicidal thoughts and they report that to me as a therapist, my referral has to be to a hospital. Now, when they go into a hospital setting, the experience ends up being more traumatic because this is just a crisis or an episode. So these clients learn not to say they're having suicidal thoughts or ideation because they don't want to go to be hospitalized. Plus, there's no follow-up after the hospitalization. So finding psychiatrists is very difficult here in San Antonio, especially for people of low income. Thank you for NAMI, and I'm going to be more in contact with them. But is there any resources that we can hook up psychiatric help and not necessarily people to be institutionalized right away?
Waikisha, I know that AFSP has tons of toolkits and resources. Do you have any answers for him?
So there are, you know, some of our chapters do create kind of resource lists. So, you know, I would say that for our South Texas chapter, which covers San Antonio, I would say to connect with our South Texas chapter and, you know, get with them to find that listing of resources, and they should be able to kind of help at least point you in the right direction.
Okay. We have to wrap this up real quick. So we will talk to you too, Brooke and Michelle, about thoughts about his statements. I mean, what do you do? And should going to the hospital be the first thing? Because a lot of people are afraid to do that. So you are listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies. You can call us at 210-614-8980, or you can email us at thesource@tpr.org. The Source continues right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies. And we are talking about suicide in America. And it has surged over the last 20 years, 33% in the overall population. Significant segments have increased far more than that. And just before the break, we were talking to Antonio, who's a psychotherapist, and he said, you know, all he can do when somebody expresses they're having suicidal thoughts is send them to the hospital. So people tend not to say they're having suicidal thoughts. I remember when my daughter was having an emotional crisis last year, I did not want to say that word because I was terrified they would hospitalize her. And I thought she needed to be with me. That would be the best place for her. So people are afraid that they will automatically be hospitalized, which, as Antonio mentioned, can be traumatic. And we got a couple of emails, and I don't have my glasses on, so I'm going to move my mic here. From Joni, she says that her ex-husband, the father of her son, died by suicide this past February. I'm really sorry about that, Joni. And we feel like so many of the places, she says, they went were not grounded in research-based scientific practice. And then we got an email from Dennis, who also said he thought that suicide evaluation should be part of an annual physical exam. Now, I bring all that up at once because it's all kind of related to this topic that we're talking about, you know, whether and what should happen when somebody expresses to a health professional that they're having suicidal thoughts. And you brought up evidence-based research. Brooke Fina, during the break, she's with Strong Star. So tell me, what do you think about all this? Yeah.
Fortunately, we're learning a lot more in the field of suicide research about what is working for people. One of those things is to help support them in these times of crisis through a list of strategies that particularly focus first on self-management, then social support. And then, you know, as a last resort, right, if those other things aren't working, to then potentially consider hospitalization for safety. For us, with our Strong Start Training Initiative, we've trained over 175 providers in Texas through the support of the Texas Veteran Family and Alliance Grant Program in an evidence-based treatment for suicide prevention called the Crisis Response Plan.
Okay.
The developer is Dr. Craig Bryan out of the National Center for Veteran Studies at University of Utah. And in that intervention, we specifically, you know, try to work with patients to work on those self-management strategies first that are very specific for them, work on the social support pieces when they're in the times of crisis. And then again, you know, if hospitalization is important for safety, of course that's considered.
Sure, but all that stuff is fantastic, and I'm happy to hear about that. But that still leaves us with Antonio having a patient. They have suicidal thoughts, and he says you have to go to the local mental health facility. That's it. So, you know, what do we do? I mean, how do we fix that? Can we fix it? Should we fix it, Michelle?
I don't know if I have an answer to that. I think that what I'd like to offer is that if, let's say, someone doesn't have a psychiatrist or thinks they need some kind of intervention, going to their own PCP and talking to their PCP tell them what's going on. Other resources is, NAMI, calling NAMI. There's 211, the United Way helpline can help as well. The suicide prevention hotline number is a wealth of information there. It's not about just if I'm suicidal and attempting suicide, but it's for family members that need resources to find a healthcare professional or a hospital or someplace to have a loved one assessed for possible inpatient or outpatient IOP or something like that.
Okay. All right. Let's go to Alondra. She's on the phone, and she's going to elaborate a little bit on the cultural divide that we have as we try to get folks help. Alondra, what was your experience? What are your thoughts?
Hi, yes. So I've been researching a lot about young Latinas, and they've had the highest suicide attempt rates across all teenage groups for the past almost 30 years. And seeing a suicide attempt rates at the very least as a cry for help, especially for recently arrived immigrants and in cities with low Hispanic populations. My question is, how can parents support these young Latinas, support their daughters, especially when they might not understand the cultural divides that these young girls are having to navigate from expectations potentially at home to fill traditional roles and the school telling them to be independent and, you know, strive for their goals, for their career? How can parents help navigate this when they themselves might not understand what their children are experiencing?
Right. That's a lot. Thank you, Alondra. Waukesha McKinney, I'm sure that AFSP in South Texas deals with those kinds of questions a lot. What's your answer?
We do deal with questions about what to do, where to go, where to find support. And we try our best to connect them with the resources that we are aware of and that we know are very useful and very helpful for families. I think that one of the bigger resources that we've been able to refer families to is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and we have also been able to connect folks to with just making them aware of what's happening and what's available within their communities. What we find is that folks, you know, the folks that we come into contact with, excuse me, I'm stuttering so much today. But with the folks that we come into contact with on a regular, you know, oftentimes the question is not necessarily whether or not my loved one needs help so much as where do we go for help. So, there are quite a few resources throughout the state of Texas. And I think the challenge is that our families just don't know where to go. And so we can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. We can call the United Way Helpline, 211, and find those resources. And then also With AFSP, like I mentioned, we try to provide that resource list that our families can access very quickly to know where to go for help.
All right. So we also have a full resource list for you up at our website, tpr.org. So please check that out after the show and keep those links handy. Michelle, I'm going to guess that you have some thoughts on what Alondra was concerned about, the cultural divide and accessing help that where the people, the therapists and other professionals understand where you're coming from.
Right. I'm Hispanic, and growing up, mental illness is taboo. And I have family members who have diagnoses, and they didn't have a doctor. They didn't go into the hospital. They stayed in the back room. And, you know, we took care of them. It was time for dinner. A plate was made for them, and it was taken to their door, so they didn't even have to come out to get it. And this is the way it was in our culture. Our home is, if you're sick, we'll take care of you. But it gets to the point where no amount of family help is enough, that we need to seek out professional help. But it's a shame that my last name is something that prevents me from getting help.
Sure.
And it shouldn't be like this. I'm a human being,
mm-hmm.
just like everybody else. I want to be treated just like everyone else. I need help. I'm a productive community member. I vote. I'm a mother. I'm a grandmother. And I shouldn't be excluded because of my last name.
So the cultural stigma is real, is what I'm hearing from you. And also, Alondra brought up, I think she was touching on gender expectations specific to the Latino community. How do you have advice for her on how to navigate that?
No, I don't. I'm not. I'm still kind of navigating.
We're all navigating that, yes, in our own cultures, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, hi. She's still there. Yeah. So do you have any questions specifically for Michelle, Alondra?
Yes. So I think my concern is mostly on parents who might not understand that this is a struggle that young Latinas face. How can we enlighten them? How can we get them to be empathetic to what they're facing, even though it might not be something that the parents themselves are experiencing?
Right. So I invite you to talk to your family members about maybe signing up for the NAMI Family to Family course. We also, thankfully, we also have a NAMI Familia a Familia, and we have some of the classes that are taking place throughout San Antonio. It's a 12-week course for family members or loved ones, so mom and dad, brother, sister, husband, wife, best friends can come to the class and learn about how to better understand what you're going through, and so that they can actually empathize and understand your struggles. So I invite you to talk to your family about signing up for the Family to Family.
All right.
I think the number is going to be up on TPR.
Yes, we'll have that at tpr.org as well. We just have a couple minutes left. So, we've talked about a lot of really hard stuff. I'd like to know if during your research, all three of you, Waikisha, Brooke, and Michelle, in your research and your experiences, is there any reason for hope here? We'd like to give you some hope before we go. Brooke?
Absolutely. I think from a research perspective, we're learning more and more each day with each research study that's going to help inform best practices and evidence-based practices. So I feel very hopeful that we'll be able to not only treat suicide, but also, do more in the preventative space.
All right. Thank you very much, all three of you. That is Brooke Fina, Michelle Mata, and Waikisha McKinney, helping us trying to figure out what to do about the increasing rates of suicide in the United States. I'm Bonnie Petrie, and for David Martin Davies, and this is The Source.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams. Direction provided by News Director Dan Katz. Technical assistance provided by Ruben Garcia. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.